Where are you going?
I'll be back in an hour.
I cross the road and walk past the coffee shop directly in front of the hotel. Then I turn onto a side street. The traffic is slower here, with fewer people on the sidewalks. My destination is about 17 minutes away. I can feel the heat rising into my chest, my legs burning as I force them onward. But no matter. Where there's a will, there's a way, as Gran liked to say. I pass a first-floor office where workers have assembled and are seated in rows, listening to a man in a suit who is gesticulating wildly in front of a podium. Charts and graphs appear on a screen behind him. I smile to myself. I know just what it's like to be a proud employee, fortunate enough to be receiving professional development. I look forward to Mr. Snow's next professional development day, about a month from now. I have never understood why some staff members complain about these events, as if they're some kind of imposition, as if self-improvement and the chance to receive a free education on guest services and hotel hygiene isn't a bonus of employment at the Regency Grand. I relish such opportunities, especially given that I was unable to pursue my dream of a post-secondary education in hotel management and hospitality. This is a bad thought. An unwelcome thought. I see Wilbur's face flash in my mind, and I have a sudden desire to punch it. But you can't punch a thought. Or if you can, it does little to change reality. My stomach rumbles as I walk. I have no lunch, didn't pack one in the morning, as I have so little in the cupboards, and could barely eat breakfast anyway. I had hoped to find some perfectly untouched crackers and perhaps a small pot of unopened jam left on a breakfast tray outside one of the rooms, maybe even a piece of fruit that I could wash and discreetly tuck away. But alas, today's guests have left me very little. In total, my tips are $20.45, which is certainly something, but not enough to placate an angry landlord or fill a fridge with anything but a few scant basics. Never mind.
The honey comes from the hive. The bees tend to the honey.
It's Mr. Snow's voice in my head this time. On the last professional development day, he covered a most important topic, how the hive mentality creates greater productivity. I took notes in a fresh new journal, and I have studied the details at length. In his hour-long lecture, Mr. Snow talked about teamwork, using a most compelling analogy to do so.
Think of this hotel as a hive,
he said, as he looked out at his staff over his owl glasses. I was listening intently to his words.
And think of yourselves as bees.
I wrote in my notebook, think of yourself as a bee. Mr. Snow continued,
we are a team, a unit, a family, a colony. When we adopt a hive mentality, it means we are all working toward the greater good of the hotel. Like bees, we recognize the importance of the hotel, our hive. We must cultivate it, clean it, care for it, because we know that without it, there will be no honey.
In my notebook, hotel equals hive. Hive equals honey. At this point, Mr. Snow's lecture took a most surprising turn.
Now, he said, gripping both hands on the podium in front of him, let us consider the hierarchy of roles within the hive and the importance of all bees, regardless of rank, working to the best of their bee abilities. There are supervisory bees.
Here he straightened his tie.
And there are worker bees. There are bees that serve others directly, and there are bees that serve indirectly. But no bee is more important than any other bee. Do you understand?
Mr. Snow's hands balled into fists to highlight the importance of this last point. I was scribbling furiously, recording every word as best I could, when suddenly Mr. Snow pointed at me in the crowd.
Take, for instance, the example of a maid. She could be any maid, anywhere. Within our hotel, she is our perfect worker bee. She toils and travails to ready each honeycomb for the arrival of honey. This is a physically demanding job. It's exhausting and mind-numbingly repetitive, and yet she takes pride in her work. She does it well each and every day. Her work is largely invisible. But does this make her lesser than the drones or the queen? Does this make her less significant to the hive? No. The truth is that without the worker bee, we have no hive. We cannot function without her.
Mr. Snow pounded the podium to underline his point. I looked around and saw many eyes upon me. Sunshine and Sunitha, who were in the row in front of me, had turned and were smiling and waving at me. Cheryl, who was a few seats away, was leaning back, her eyes slits, her arms crossed. Rodney and some of the waitresses from the social were behind me, and as I turned to look over my shoulder, they whispered to one another, laughing at some joke I'd missed. All around, employees I knew, but most of whom had never spoken to me, were looking my way. Mr. Snow continued,
"We have much to improve upon in this organization, and I'm increasingly becoming aware that our hive does not always operate as a cohesive unit. We create honey for our guests to enjoy, but sometimes the sweetness is skimmed off the top and isn't shared equitably. Some of our hive is used nefariously, for personal gain rather than for the common good."
At this, I stopped taking notes because Cheryl began dry coughing in a very distracting manner. I turned around once more and saw Rodney sinking into his chair. Mr. Snow carried on.
"I'm here to remind you that you're all better than that, that we can strive for something more together, that our hive can be the greatest, fittest, cleanest, most luxurious hive of any bees anywhere, but it will take cohesion and cooperation. It will take a commitment to the hive mentality. I'm asking you to help the colony for the colony. I want you to think about pristine professionalism, polished poise. I want you to clean this place up."
At this point, I bounded out of my chair and onto my feet. I had fully expected that the entire staff would recognize Mr. Snow's glorious conclusion and would spontaneously burst into applause. But I was the only one on my feet. I was standing alone in a room that was pin-drop silent. I felt myself turn to stone. I knew I should probably sit, but I couldn't. I was frozen. Stuck. I stayed that way for a very long time. Mr. Snow remained at the podium for a minute or two. Then he straightened his glasses, grabbed his speech, and marched back to his office. Once he was gone, my coworkers shifted in their seats and started talking among themselves. I could hear the whispers all around me. Did they actually think I couldn't? Molly the mutant. Roomba the robot. The formality freak. Eventually, the reception desk penguins and porters, the waitresses and valets, got up in their little cliques and began to drift away. I remained where I was until I was the last bee in the room.
"Molly,"
I heard behind me. I felt a familiar hand on my arm.
"Molly, are you quite all right?"
I turned and saw Mr. Preston standing in front of me. I searched his face for clues. Was he friend or foe? Sometimes this happens. I'll freeze for a moment because everything I've ever learned is gone. Erased.
"It wasn't about you," he said.
"I'm sorry," I replied.
"What Mr. Snow was saying about how this hotel might not be so squeaky clean, how some employees skim off the top, that wasn't about you, Molly. There are things happening in this hotel, things even I don't fully understand. But you don't have to worry about that. Everyone knows you do your best every day."
"But they don't respect me. I don't think my coworkers like me at all." He was holding his cap in his hand. He sighed and looked down at it.
"I respect you, and I like you very much."
As he looked at me, the warmth in his eyes radiated out. Somehow, that look unlocked me. My legs became mobile again.
"Thank you, Mr. Preston," I said. "I think I should get back to it. The hive never rests and all that."
I broke away from him and went straight back to work. That was months ago. Now I'm standing outside a storefront a few blocks away from the hotel. My legs are stuck again, just like they were that day. I already went in the store. I showed the man behind the counter the goods. He offered me a price. I accepted. In place of what was there before, in the cup of my brassiere, resting against my heart, there is now a thick wad of bills wrapped in a tissue. I check the time on my phone. This whole transaction, including the walk here, has taken me 25 minutes, which is 5 minutes less than my original estimation, which means I'll arrive back at work approximately 5 minutes before one, when, as Cheryl so kindly reminded me, the second half of my shift begins. My stomach twists, like the dragon that resides there just flipped its tail and sent acid sloshing everywhere. Maybe I shouldn't have done this. Maybe it was wrong. I catch my reflection in the glass. I remember Mr. Black's sallow, downturned face, the dark bruises he inflicted, the pain he has caused. The monster in my belly curls into a tight ball and lies down. What's done is done. A lightness descends. I fill myself with breath. I marvel at my reflection in the glass. A maid, in a crisp white dress shirt with a starched collar. I adjust my posture. I stand tall in a way that would make Gran proud. Beyond my reflection are the goods on offer in the shop window. A shiny saxophone in a red velvet case. Some solid power tools, their cords neatly wrapped into figure eights held tight with elastic bands. A few tired old cell phones, and some jewelry in a display case. In the middle of the case is a new addition, a ring, a man's ring, a wedding ring, encrusted in diamonds and other jewels, gleaming, an object of obvious and rare luxury, a fine treasure. I could tell the shopkeeper felt sorry for me when he handed over the agreed-upon sum, the tight lips, the smile that wasn't a smile. I'm beginning to understand the nuances of smiles, their cornucopia of meanings. I save each smile in a dictionary that I keep alphabetized on a shelf in my mind.
"I'm sorry things didn't turn out the way you'd hoped," the shopkeeper said. "With your man, I mean."
"With my man," I replied. "On the contrary," I say, "for the first time in a long time, things are going well with him. Very well indeed."
Chapter 12. I walk briskly the entire way back to the hotel, checking the time frequently. I'm making good progress. It's now 5 to 1, and I'm nearly at the hotel, my time estimation almost exactly right. I'm a bit flushed from the walk, and the wad of bills over my heart is slightly damp, but no matter. It would appear the hotel has cleared out a bit since the morning. There are fewer guests about. Mr. Preston is alone at his doorman's podium. When he sees me approaching, he steps out from behind it, his arms oddly stiff by his sides. I wave and rush up the stairs, but Mr. Preston calls down before I reach the top.
"Molly," he says, his voice a tense whisper, "go home."
I stop on the third stair. His expression is odd, as though he very much needs a washroom break. "Mr. Preston, I can't go home now. I'm only halfway through my shift."
"Molly," he calls down again, "use the back door. Please."
"Are you quite all right, Mr. Preston? Do you need assistance?" It's only then that it comes into focus. The absence of guests in the grand entrance. Mr. Preston standing too formally at the podium, his strange whispered orders. Through the glass of the revolving doors, I can make out Mr. Snow and beside him a looming shadowy figure, Detective Stark.
My dear girl, Mr. Preston says, don't go inside.
It's quite all right, I say, as I march up the remaining steps. A few more questions won't kill me. I push through the doors. Before I can take more than one step into the lobby, Mr. Snow and Detective Stark block my path. There's something about Detective Stark's posture that I don't like. The way her arms are bowed and her hands outstretched, as if I'm a varmint she's determined to catch before I take flight. I see Cheryl out of the corner of my eye, standing a few trolley lengths away, but there's something different about her, too. It's the first time I've seen a genuine smile on her face, a look of anticipation and excitement. Excuse me, I say to Mr. Snow and Detective Stark. I must not dilly-dally. The rest of my shift begins in approximately 3 minutes.
I'm afraid it doesn't, says Detective Stark.
I look to Mr. Snow, but he can barely meet my eye. His glasses are cantilevered to one side. Beads of sweat have formed at his temples.
Molly, the detective is taking you back to the station for more questioning.
Can't I answer questions here and then get back to work? I have a heavy workload today.
That won't be possible, says Detective Stark. There's an easy way and a hard way to do everything, and the easy way is best.
It's an interesting comment, but it's dead wrong. In my line of work, the easy way is the lazy way, not the best way at all. But since we're in the hotel, and that technically makes the detective a guest, I will be polite and bite my tongue. I look around the lobby again and notice that more people have begun to gather. They're not milling about, heading to and fro the way they usually do. They've formed little clusters by the reception desk, in the lounge chairs, on the marble landing by the grand staircase. They're oddly static and quiet. They're all looking in one direction. Their cold eyes are looking at me. Well, Detective Stark, I say, I'll accept the easy way. I look at Mr. Snow and add, but just this once. Detective Stark gestures for me to lead the way out the revolving doors, which I do, as she follows too closely behind me. As I pass, I take one glance back and see all eyes tracking my departure. Mr. Preston is outside the door at the top of the stairs.
Here, he says, taking my elbow. Allow me to help you, Molly.
I'm about to tell him I'm quite all right, but as I look down at the stairs, the red carpet undulates in a vertigo-inducing wave. I hold tightly to Mr. Preston's arm. It feels warm, comforting. We are at the bottom of the staircase. Detective Stark says,
let's go. It's time.
Molly, take good care, Mr. Preston says.
I always do, I reply, not entirely believing my own words. Chapter 13. The car ride is silent. This time, I'm seated in the back of the police cruiser instead of up front. I don't like it back here. The vinyl upholstery squeaks under me every time I make the slightest move. A bulletproof glass barrier separates Detective Stark from me. It is smeared with grubby fingerprints and dark brown bloodstains.
Imagine you're in a limousine, sitting in the back seat, being driven to the opera.
Gran reminds me that entrapment is only a state of mind, that there's always a way out. I join my hands in my lap and breathe deeply. I will admire the view out the window. Yes, I will concentrate on that. We are at the station in what feels like seconds. Once inside, Detective Stark leads me to the same white room in which I was questioned before. On our way there, I feel more eyes upon me. Uniformed officers who gawk as I pass, some of them offering a nod, not to me, but to Detective Stark. I hold my head high.
Have a seat, the detective says.
I sit down in the same seat where I sat before, and Detective Stark sits across from me. She closes the door. She doesn't offer me coffee or even water this time, which is a shame. I could use some water, though I know if I ask for some it will arrive in a dastardly styrofoam cup.
Shoulders back, chin up, breathe.
Detective Stark has not said a word. She's sitting there in front of me, watching me. The camera in the corner blinks its red eye at me. I'm the first to break the silence. How may I be of service to you, Detective Stark? I ask.
How can you be of service to me? Well, Molly the maid, you can start by telling the truth.
My gran used to say that the truth is subjective, but I've never quite believed that. I believe the truth is absolute, I say.
Then there's something we agree on, Detective Stark replies.
She leans forward and puts her elbows on the scuffed white table between us. I wish she wouldn't. I disapprove of elbows on the table, but I don't say anything. She is close enough that I can see tiny gold flecks in the irises of her blue eyes.
Since we're talking about truth, she says, I'd like to share with you the results of Mr. Black's toxicology report. No autopsy report yet, but we'll have that soon enough. Mr. Black had drugs in his system, the same drug that was on his bedside table and strewn on the floor of his bedroom.
Giselle's medicine, I say.
Medicine? Benzodiazepine, laced with some other street drugs.
It takes me a moment to change the picture in my head from Giselle at the drugstore counter to her acquiring something illicit in a sordid back alley. Something isn't right. It doesn't make sense.
Anyhow, Detective Stark says, it wasn't the pills that killed him. He had a lot in his system, but not enough to kill him.
What do you believe killed him then? I ask.
We don't know yet. But I assure you, we'll get to the bottom of it, she says. The full autopsy report will determine if the petechial hemorrhaging was due to a cardiac arrest or if something more sinister happened.
It comes back to me in a flash. The room starts to spin. I see Mr. Black, his skin gray and taut, the little pinprick bruises around his eyes, his body stiff and lifeless. After I made the call to the front desk, I looked up. I caught my reflection in the mirror on the wall in front of the bed. Suddenly, I feel clammy and cold, like I'm about to faint. Detective Stark purses her lips, bides her time. Eventually, she says,
If you know something, now's your chance to be on the side of good. You do understand that Mr. Black was a very important man, a VIP.
No, I say.
Excuse me? Detective Stark replies.
I don't believe that some people are more important than other people. We're all very important in our own way, Detective. For instance, I'm sitting here with you, a lowly hotel maid, and yet clearly there is something very important about me. Otherwise, you wouldn't have brought me here today. Detective Stark is listening carefully. She zeroes in on my every word.
Let me ask you something, she says. Does it ever make you angry? Being a maid, I mean. Cleaning up after rich people. Taking care of their messes.
I'm impressed by this line of questioning. This is not what I was expecting at all when I was escorted here. Yes, I answer truthfully. I do sometimes feel angry, especially when guests are careless, when they forget that their actions have an impact on others, when I'm treated like I don't matter. Detective Stark says nothing. Her elbows remain on the table, which continues to grate on my nerves, even though it's only officially a breach of etiquette when there's a meal being served. Now, let me ask you a question, I say. Does it ever bother you?
Does what ever bother me?
Cleaning up after rich people. Taking care of their messes, I say. The detective pulls back, as though I've sprouted the head of Hydra and 100 serpents are hissing in her face. What pleases me, though, is that her elbows are no longer on the table.
Is that how you see this? That my job as a detective is to clean up after a man has died?
What I'm saying is that we're not so different when it comes down to it.
Is that so?
You want this mess cleaned up, and so do I. We both seek a tidy closure to this unfortunate situation, a return to normalcy.
What I'm seeking is the truth, Molly, about how Mr. Black died. And right now, I also want to know the truth about you. We've uncovered some interesting information in the last 48 hours. When we spoke the other day, you said you didn't know Giselle Black particularly well. But as it turns out, that's not true.
I won't give her the satisfaction of flinching. Giselle is my friend. I've never had a friend like her before, and I'm acutely aware of how easy it would be to lose her. I consider how to protect her and tell the truth at the same time. Giselle has confided in me in the past. That doesn't mean I know her as well as I'd like. Mr. Black definitely had a temper. It was hard not to notice Giselle's bruises. She confessed he was the cause of them.
You do realize we've been talking to other employees at the hotel, right?
I would have expected as much, yes. I'm sure you'll find them very helpful to your investigation, I say.
They've told us a lot. Not only about Giselle and Mr. Black, but about you.
I feel my stomach twist. Surely, whoever spoke to Detective Stark would have been fair in their commentary, even if I'm not their cup of tea. And if the detective consulted Mr. Snow, Mr. Preston, or Rodney, she would have received a glowing report on my employee conduct and general reliability. A thought occurs to me. Cheryl. She was sick yesterday, though probably not so sick that she couldn't make her way down to this very station. As if reading my mind, the detective says,
Molly, we've been talking to Cheryl, your supervisor.
I do hope she was helpful, I reply, though I highly doubt she was.
We asked Cheryl if she ever cleaned the Black suite when they stayed at the hotel. She said that for a while she did clean their suite alongside you. It was her way of maintaining quality control and keeping her maids sharp.
The acid builds in my stomach.
It was her way of siphoning off tips that were meant for those who do the work rather than for those who stand around watching, I say.
The detective ignores my words entirely.
Cheryl said that she observed a friendly relationship between you and Giselle, a kind of special kinship. That was unusual between a guest and a maid, especially for you, since you don't really have friends, so I'm told.
I knew Cheryl was watching me, but I never realized just how much. I take a moment to collect my thoughts before I respond. Giselle was grateful for my services, I say. That was the basis for our relationship.
Tell me, did you ever receive tips from Giselle, or large sums of money? She asks.
She and Mr. Black tipped me well, I answer. I won't go into further details about the countless times Giselle placed brand new $100 bills into the palm of my hand to thank me for keeping the suite clean. And I won't mention her visit to my home, nor the charitable monetary gift she left me last night. It's no one's business except mine.
Did Giselle ever give you anything besides money?
Kindness, friendship, help, trust. Nothing out of the ordinary, I say.
Nothing at all.
Detective Stark digs in her pocket and takes out a small key. She opens a drawer in the table between us. She takes out the timer, Giselle's timer, her golden gift to me. The detective places it on the table. I feel a surge of heat rise to my face. Cheryl let you into my locker.
That's my locker. It's my personal space. That's not right, invading someone's privacy, touching their things without permission. Those lockers are hotel property, Molly. Please remember, you're just an employee, not the owner of the hotel. Now, tell me, are you ready to confess the truth about you and Giselle?
The truth about Giselle and me is something I barely understand. It's as strange as a baby rhino being adopted by a tortoise. How am I supposed to explain such a thing? I don't know what to tell you, I say.
Then let me tell you something, Detective Stark replies as her elbows reclaim the table. You're rapidly becoming a person of interest to us. Do you understand what that means?
I'm detecting an air of condescension. I've encountered this before. People who assume that I'm a complete idiot just because I don't grasp things that come easily to them.
You're becoming a VIP, Molly, Detective Stark adds, and not the good kind. You've proven that you're capable of leaving out important details, of bending the truth to suit you. I'm going to ask you one more time. Are you in contact with Giselle Black?
I deliberate once more
and find I'm able to answer this with 100% honesty. I am not currently in contact with Giselle, though as I understand it, she remains a guest at the hotel.
Let's hope for your sake that's the truth. And let's hope the autopsy report shows a natural cause of death. Until then, you're not to leave the country or attempt to hide from us in any way. You're not under arrest.
I most certainly hope not. I've done nothing wrong.
Do you have a valid passport?
No. She cocks her head to one side.
If you're lying, I'll find out. I can look you up, you know.
And when you do, I say, you'll find that I do not have a passport because I've never left the country in my life. You'll also find I'm a model citizen and that I have a completely clean record.
Don't go anywhere. You understand?
It's precisely this kind of language that always trips me up. May I go to my home? May I go to the store? To the restroom? And what about work? She sighs.
Yes, of course you can go home and to all the places you'd usually go. And yes, you can go to work. What I'm saying is, we'll be watching you.
Here we go again. Watching me do what? I ask. Her eyes drill into mine.
Whatever it is you're hiding, whoever you're trying to protect, we'll find out. One thing I've learned in my business is that you can hide dirt for a while, but at some point, it all comes to the surface. Do you understand?
You're asking me if I understand dirt?
Smudges on doorknobs, shoe prints on floors, dust rings on tabletops.
Mr. Black, dead in his bed. Yes, detective. I understand dirt better than most. Chapter 14. It is 3:30 when Detective Stark dismisses me from the White Room. I walk myself out the station door. No courtesy ride home this time. I haven't eaten since the morning, and I haven't had so much as a cup of tea to tide me over. My stomach roils. The dragon awakes. I have to pause a moment on the sidewalk in front of my building just to keep from fainting. It's my deception, not hunger, that's having a deleterious effect on my nerves. It's the fact that I haven't disclosed fully about Giselle, nor about what I currently have hidden over my heart. That's what has me in such a state. Honesty is the only policy. I can see Gran's face, twisted with disappointment, the day I came home from school at the age of 12, and she asked me how my day was. I told her it was ordinary, nothing to report. That, too, was a lie. The truth was, I ran away at lunchtime, which was far from ordinary. The school called Gran. I confessed to Gran why I'd run away. My classmates had formed a ring around me in the schoolyard and ordered me to roll around in the mud and eat it, kicking me while I obeyed their order. They were keenly inventive when it came to tormenting me, and this iteration was no exception. When the ordeal was over, I went to the community library and spent hours in the bathroom washing the grime off my face and mouth, scraping the earth out from under my fingernails. I watched with satisfaction as the evidence circled down the drain. I was so certain I'd get away with it, that Gran would never find out. But she did find out, and she had only one question for me after I confessed to being bullied.
Dear girl, why didn't you just tell the truth right away? To your teacher? To me? To anyone?
Then she cried, and embraced me with such force that I was never able to answer her question. But I had an answer. I did. I didn't tell the truth because the truth hurt. What happened at school was bad enough, but Gran knowing about my suffering meant she experienced my pain too. That's the trouble with pain. It's as contagious as a disease. It spreads from the person who first endured it to those who love them most. Truth isn't always the highest ideal. Sometimes it must be sacrificed to stop the spread of pain to those you love. Even children know this intuitively. My stomach settles,
Steadiness returns. I cross the street and enter my building. I bound up the stairs to my floor, heading straight for Mr. Rosso's door. I extricate the wad of bills I've placed by my heart for safekeeping. I was aware of them the whole time I was at the police station, but far from being a nuisance, they felt protective, like a shield. I knock loudly. I hear Mr. Rosso padding down his hallway, then the scratchy squeal of the lock twisting. My landlord's face appears, ruddy and bulbous. I hold out the bills in my hand. "Here is the rest of this month's rent," I say. "As you can see, I take after my gran. I'm a woman of my word." He takes the money and counts it. "It's all there, but I appreciate your diligence," I say. When he's done counting, he nods slowly.
"Molly, let's not do this every month, okay? I know your grandmother's gone, but you need to pay your rent on time. You need to get your life in order."
"I'm well aware of that," I say. "As for order, it is my express wish to live as ordered a life as possible, but the world is filled with random chaos that often bedevils my attempts at arrangement. May I have my receipt for full payment, please?"
He sighs.
I know what this means. He's exasperated, which does not seem fair. If someone were to place a wad of bills into my hands, rest assured I would not sigh like this. I'd be grateful beyond measure.
"I'll fill out a receipt tonight," he says, "and give it to you tomorrow."
I would much prefer to have that receipt in my hand, toot sweet, but I defer. "That would be acceptable. Thank you," I say. "And have a lovely evening." He closes his door without so much as a mannered "you too." I go to my own entrance and turn the key. I step across the threshold and lock the door behind me. Our home. My home. Exactly as I left it this morning. Neat. Orderly. Unnervingly quiet, despite Gran's voice in my head.
"There are times in life when we must do things we don't want to, but do them we must."
Normally, I feel a wave of relief flow through me the instant I close the door behind me. Here, I'm safe. No expressions to interpret, no conversations to decode, no requests, no demands. I take off my shoes, wipe them down, and place them neatly in the closet. I pat Gran's serenity pillow on the chair by the door. I take a seat on the sofa in the living room to collect my thoughts. I am all a muddle, even here, in the peace of my own home. I know I must consider my next steps. Should I call Giselle? Or maybe Rodney? For support and advice? Mr. Snow, to apologize for my absence this afternoon, for leaving my rooms without completing my daily quota? But I find myself overwhelmed by the very thought of it all. I feel out of sorts in a way I haven't felt in a while, not since Wilbur and the Fabergé, not since the day Gran died. In that too bright station room today, Detective Stark laid blame on me, treating me like some sort of common criminal, when I'm nothing of the sort. All I want is to turn my head and find Gran sitting on the sofa beside me, saying, "Dear girl, do not fret yourself into a tizzy. Life has a way of sorting itself out." I head to the kitchen and put the kettle on. My hands are shaky. I open the fridge and find it mostly bare, just a couple of crumpets left, which I should save for tomorrow's breakfast. I find a few biscuits in the cupboard and arrange them neatly on a plate. When the water has boiled, I make my tea, adding 2 sugars to compensate for the lack of milk. I mean to savor each bite of the biscuits, but instead I find myself devouring them greedily and washing them down with big gulps of tea right at the kitchen counter. My cup is empty before I even know it. Instantly, I feel the tea working. Warm energy flows through me again.
"When all else fails, tidy up."
It's a good idea. Nothing raises my spirits more than a good tidy. I wash out my teacup, dry it, and put it away. Gran's curio cabinet in the living room could use a bit of attention. I carefully open the glass doors and remove all of her precious treasures, a menagerie of Swarovski crystal animals,
each one paid for with back-breaking overtime hours at the Caldwell's mansion. There are spoons, too, silver mostly, collected from thrift shops over the years. And the photos. Gran and me baking. Gran and me in front of a water fountain in a park. Gran and me at the Olive Garden. Glasses of Chardonnay raised. And the one photo that is not of us, but of my mother, when she was young. I pick it up. My hands still aren't entirely steady. I have to concentrate as I dust and polish the glass frame. If my fingers slip, the frame will fall to the floor. The glass will shatter into hundreds of deadly shards. I get down on my knees to be closer to the ground. It's safer this way. I'm holding the frame in both hands, studying my mother's image. I'm surrounded by all of Gran's lovely things. Another memory surfaces. Not a recent one. One I haven't thought about in a long time. I was about 13 years old when I walked through the door after school one day to find Gran kneeling on the floor much like I'm doing now. It was Thursday. Dust we must. And she'd started the chore, her collection strewn about her, a polishing cloth and this photo of my mother in her hands. As soon as I crossed the threshold, I knew something wasn't quite right. Gran was disheveled. Her hair, which was usually perfectly curled and coiffed, was in disarray. There were stains on her cheeks and her eyes were puffy. "Gran?" I asked, before even wiping down the bottoms of my shoes. "Are you all right?" She didn't answer. She just stared at me with a glassy, faraway look in her eyes. Then she said, "Dear girl, I'm simply going to tell it to you as it is. Your mother. She's dead." I found myself glued to the spot where I stood. I knew that my mother was out there in the world somewhere, but to me, she was as abstract a figure as the Queen. To me, it was as if she'd died long ago. But to Gran, she meant so much, and this is what had me worried. Every year, as Mother's Day drew near, Gran would begin her thrice daily peregrinations to our mailbox. She was hoping there'd be a card from my mother. In the early years, cards appeared, signed in shaky scrawl. Gran would be so happy. "She's still in there somewhere, my little girl," she'd say. But for years on end, Mother's Day after Mother's Day, no cards arrived, and Gran would be glum for the rest of the month. I compensated by splurging on the biggest, cheeriest card I could find, adding a Gran before Mother, filling the inside with evenly spaced X's and O's and red and pink hearts that I'd color in, careful not to stray outside the lines. When Gran told me my mother was dead, it wasn't my own pain that I felt, it was hers. She cried and cried and cried, which was so unlike her that it unsettled me to my core. I hurried to her side and placed a hand on her back. "What you need is a good cup of tea," I said. "There's almost nothing that a good cup of tea can't cure." I rushed to the kitchen and put the kettle on, my hands shaking. I could hear Gran sobbing on the sitting room floor. Once the water had boiled, I made two perfect cups and brought them to the living room on Gran's silver tray. "There we are," I said. "Why don't we have a wee sit on the sofa?" But Gran wouldn't move. The polishing cloth was balled up in one of her hands. I stepped through the obstacle course of treasures and cleared myself a spot beside her on the floor. I put the tray down to one side, picked up both teacups and positioned them in front of us. I put one hand on Gran's shoulder again. "Gran," I said, "will you sit up? Will you join me for tea?" My voice was trembling. I was terrified. I'd never seen Gran so weak and diminished, as fragile as a baby bird. Gran eventually sat up. She dabbed at her eyes with the polishing cloth. "Oh," she said, "tea." We sat like that, Gran and me on the floor, drinking tea, surrounded by Swarovski crystal animals and silver spoons. my mother's photo was beside us, the absent third person at our tea party. When Gran spoke next, her voice had returned, composed and steady.
"Dear girl," she said, "I'm sorry I was so upset, but not to worry. I'm feeling much better now."
She took a small sip from her cup and smiled at me. It was not her usual smile. It traveled only halfway across her face. A question occurred to me. Did she ever ask about me, my mother?
Of course she did, dear. When she'd call out of the blue, it was often to ask about you. I'd update her, of course, for as long as she'd listen. Sometimes that wasn't very long.
Because she was unwell? I asked. This was the word Gran always used to explain why my mother had left in the first place.
Yes, because she was terribly unwell. When she called me, it was usually from the streets. But when I stopped providing funds, she stopped calling.
And my father? I asked. What happened to him?
Like I've said before, he was not a good egg. I tried to help your mother see this. I even called old friends to help me coax her away from him, but that proved ineffective.
Gran paused and took another sip of tea.
You must promise me, dear girl, to never get mixed up with drugs.
Her eyes filled with tears. I promise, Gran, I said. I didn't know what else to say, so I reached out and hugged her. I could feel her holding on to me in a whole new way. It was the only time I ever felt that I was giving her a hug rather than the other way round. When we separated, I didn't know what the correct etiquette was. I said, "What do you say, Gran? When all else fails, tidy up?" She nodded.
"My dear girl, you're a treasure to me. That you are. Shall we tackle this mess together?"
And with that, Gran was back. Perhaps she was dissimulating, but as we arranged all of her trinkets, freshly cleaned and polished, and put them back in the curio cabinet, she chirped and chattered on as though it were an ordinary day. We never spoke of my mother again after that. Here I am now, in the same spot as I was that day, surrounded by a menagerie of mementos. But this time, I'm dreadfully alone. "Gran," I say to the empty room, "I think I'm in trouble." I arrange the photos on top of the curio cabinet. I polish each of Gran's treasures and stow them safely behind the glass. I stand in front of the cabinet, looking at everything inside. I don't know what to do.
"You're never alone, as long as you have a friend.
I've been managing on my own through most of this, but perhaps it really is time to call for help." I go to the front door where I left my phone. I pick it up and dial Rodney. He answers after the second ring.
"Hello?"
"Hello, Rodney," I say. "I hope I haven't caught you at an inopportune moment."
"All good," he says. "What's up?" "I saw you leave the hotel with the cops. Everyone's talking, saying you're in trouble."
"I'm sorry to report that in this particular case, the gossip may be correct."
"What did the police want?"
"The truth," I say, "about me. About Giselle. Mr. Black didn't die of an overdose. Not exactly."
"Oh, thank God for that. What did he die of?"
"They don't know yet, but it's clear they suspect me, and maybe Giselle too."
"But you didn't tell them anything about her, did you?"
"Not much," I say.
"And you didn't mention Juan Manuel or any of that, right?"
"What does he have to do with anything?"
"Nothing. Nothing at all. So, why are you calling me?"
"Rodney, I need help." My voice cracks and I find it difficult to maintain my composure. He goes quiet for a moment, then asks,
Did you kill Mr. Black?
No, of course not. How could you even...
Sorry. Forget I even said that. So, how are you in trouble exactly?
Giselle, she had me go back into the suite because she'd left something behind. A gun. She wanted it back. And she's my friend, so I...
Jesus.
There's a pause on the other end of the line.
Right.
Rodney?
Yes, I'm here, he says. So, where's that gun now?
In my vacuum cleaner, by my locker.
We have to get that gun, Rodney says.
I can hear the agitation in his voice.
We have to make it disappear.
Yes, exactly, I say. Oh, Rodney, I'm so sorry to involve you in all of this. And please, if the police ever talk to you, you have to tell them I'm not a bad person, that I would never hurt anyone.
Don't worry, Molly. I'll take care of everything.
I feel raw gratitude climbing up my chest, threatening to spill out of me in blubbering tears. But I won't let that happen, in case Rodney finds it unbecoming. I want this experience to draw us closer, not break us apart. I take a deep breath and push my sentiments back down. Thank you, Rodney, I say. You're a good friend. More than that, even. I don't know what I'd do without you.
I've got your back, he says.
But there's more. I fear that when he hears the rest, he may turn away from me forever. There's another spot of information, I say. Mr. Black's wedding ring. I found it in the suite, and, well, this is very hard for me to admit, but I've recently found myself in some acute financial distress. I took the ring to a pawn shop today so that I could pay my rent.
You what?
It's on display in a shop window downtown.
I can't believe it. I really can't believe it, he replies.
I can hear him almost laughing, as if this is the most wonderful news. Surely he doesn't find this funny. It strikes me that laughs are just like smiles. People use them to express an array of confounding emotions. I've made a terrible mistake, I say. I never thought they'd interrogate me again. I thought my part in all of this was over. If the police find out I pawned Mr. Black's ring, it will appear as though I killed him for financial gain. Can you see that?
Absolutely I can, says Rodney. Wow, it's incredible. Listen, everything's going to turn out just fine. Leave everything to me.
Will you make the gun go away? And the ring? I should never have taken it. It was wrong. Will you buy it back and make sure that no one ever sees it again? I'll pay you back someday. You have my word.
Like I said, Molly, leave everything in my hands. You're at home now?
Yes, I say.
Don't go out tonight, okay? Don't go anywhere.
I never do, Rodney, I say. I can't thank you enough.
That's what friends are for, right? To help each other out of binds?
Right, I say. That's what friends are for. Rodney, I say into the receiver. I'm about to add that I most desperately would like to be more than just a friend to him, but it's too late. He's hung up without saying goodbye. I've left him with quite a mess to tidy, and he's not wasting a moment. When all of this is over, I'm going to take him on an all-expenses-paid tour of Italy. We will sit in our private booth at the Olive Garden under the warm glow of the pendant light, and we will eat mountains of salad and bread, followed by a universe of pasta, and topped by a smorgasbord of sweet desserts. Somehow, when we're done, I will pick up the bill. I will pay for all of this. I know I will.
Thursday. Chapter 15. The next morning I'm at the hotel, and I'm late, oh so very late.
No matter how hard I work, no matter how many rooms I clean, I can't keep up. I finish one room, and an obsidian door, like a great gaping maw, opens to the next guest room just down the hall. There's dirt everywhere, grit ground into the pile of every carpet, cracks in all the mirrors, greasy smudges on tabletops, and bloody fingerprints smeared across twisted sheets. Suddenly, I'm climbing the grand terrace staircase in the lobby, desperate to get away. My hands clutch the golden serpent balustrades, each one slippery to the touch. The beady reptilian eyes look familiar, then they blink and come to life under my fingers. With each step I take, a new serpent awakens. Cheryl, Mr. Snow, Wilbur, the tattooed behemoths, Mr. Rosso, Detective Stark, Rodney, Giselle, and finally, Mr. Black.
No!
I scream. But then I hear knocking. I sit bolt upright in bed, my heart pounding in my chest. Gran! I call out. It comes back to me as it does every morning. I'm alone in the world. Knock, knock, knock. I check my phone. It's not quite 7 in the morning, so my alarm has not yet gone off. Who in their right mind would be rapping on my door at this most inconvenient hour? Then I remember Mr. Rosso, who owes me my receipt for rent paid. I haul myself out of bed and put my slippers on.
Coming, I say. Just one moment.
I shake away the nightmare and walk down the hallway to the front door. I slide the rusty deadbolt across, then turn the lock and open the door wide. Mr. Rosso, while I appreciate you bringing... But mid-sentence I stop cold because it's not Mr. Rosso at the door. An imposing young police officer is standing with his feet apart, blocking all the light. Behind him are two more officers, a middle-aged man who would fit in fine in Columbo, and Detective Stark. Please excuse me, I'm not properly dressed, I say. I clutch at the collar of my pajamas, which used to be Gran's, pink flannel with a delightful array of multicolored teapots all over them. This is no way to greet guests, even ones impolite enough to arrive unannounced at an inconvenient hour of the morning.
Molly, Detective Stark says, stepping in front of the young officer, you're under arrest for unlawful possession of a firearm, possession of drugs, and first-degree murder. You have the right to remain silent and to refuse to answer questions. Anything you say may be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to consult an attorney before speaking to the police and to have an attorney present during questioning now or in the future.
My head is spinning. The floor is tilting under my feet. Tiny teapots spin before my eyes. Would anyone like a cup of... But I can't finish the question because my vision dims. The last thing I remember is my knees turning to marmalade and all the world fading to black. When I come to... I'm in a holding cell, lying down on a tiny gray cot. I remember my front door, opening it, and the shock of my rights being read to me just like on TV. Was that real? I sit up, slowly. I take in the small room with bars. Yes, it's all real. I'm in a jail cell, probably in the basement of the same station I visited twice before for questioning. I take a few breaths, willing myself to remain calm. It smells dry and dusty. I'm still wearing my pajamas, which strikes me as entirely unsuitable apparel for this particular situation. The cot I'm sitting on is stained with what Gran would call unresolvable dirt. Smeared blood and some yellow circular stains that could be many things that I don't want to think about. This cot is an example of a perfectly serviceable item that should immediately be disposed of because there is simply no way to restore it to a state of perfection. How sanitary is the rest of this cell? I wonder. It occurs to me that a far worse job than being a hotel maid would be working as a janitor in such a place. Imagine the plethora of bacteria and filth that has accumulated here over the years. No, I cannot focus on that. I put my slippered feet on the floor. Count your blessings. My blessings. I'm about to start at number 1, but when I look down at my hands, I see they are besmirched, stained. I have dark black ink marks on every finger. It comes back to me then. Lying on this cot in this cramped, germ-infested cell, two police officers guiding each of my fingers toward a jet-black ink blotter. They didn't even have the decency to allow me to wash my hands after, though I did ask. After that, I don't remember much. Perhaps I fainted again. It's hard to say how long ago that was. It could have been 5 minutes, or 5 hours. Before I can think about anything else, the young police officer who was at my door at home appears on the other side of the cell bars.
"You're awake," he says. "You're at the police station. Do you understand? You passed out at your front door and in here, too. We read you your rights. You're under arrest. Multiple charges. Do you remember?"
"Yes," I say. "I can't recall what exactly I've been arrested for, but I know it most certainly has to do with the death of Mr. Black." Detective Stark appears beside the young officer. She's in plain clothes now, but this does nothing to alter the dread I feel the moment her eyes meet mine.
"I'll take it from here," she says. "Molly, come with me."
The young officer turns a key in the cell door and holds it open for me.
"Thank you," I say as I pass.
Detective Stark leads the way. Behind me, the young officer follows, making sure I'm hemmed in. I'm escorted down a hallway with three other cells. I try not to look inside them, but it's futile. I catch a glimpse of a sallow-faced man with sores on his face, holding on to the bars of his cell. Opposite him, a young woman in torn clothing lies crying in her cot.
"Count your blessings."
We go up some stairs. I avoid touching the railings, which are coated with filth and grime. Eventually, we arrive at a familiar room that I've visited twice before. Detective Stark flicks on the lights.
"Sit," she orders. "You've been here so often, it must feel like home."
"It's nothing like home," I say, my voice like a blade, cutting and sharp. I sit in the wobbly chair behind the dirty white table, careful not to touch my back against the rest. My feet are cold, despite my fuzzy slippers. The young officer walks in with a coffee in a dastardly styrofoam cup, two creamers, and a muffin on a paper plate, and a metal spoon. He puts all of this down on the table, then leaves. Detective Stark closes the door behind him.
"Eat," she says. "We don't want you passing out again."
"That's very thoughtful," I reply, because you're supposed to say something complimentary when offered food. I don't believe she's being authentically caring, but it hardly matters. I'm ravenous. My body craves sustenance. I need it to carry on, to get me through what's next. I pick up the spoon, turn it over in my hand. There's a dried clump of gray matter on the underside. I put it down immediately.
"You take cream in your coffee?" Detective Stark asks. She's taken a seat across from me at the table.
"Just one," I say. "Thank you." She reaches out for the creamer, opens it, and pours it into the cup. She's about to grab the revolting spoon and stir.
"No,"
I say. "I prefer my coffee unstirred." She stares at me with that look of hers that is becoming easier and easier to interpret. Derision and disgust. She hands me the styrofoam cup. It makes that horrific squeaky sound as I take it in my hand. I can't help but cringe. Detective Stark pushes the plate with the muffin closer to me.
"Eat," she says again. An order, not an invitation.
"Thank you very much," I say as I delicately pry the muffin from the paper lining, then sever it into four neat pieces. I pop one quarter into my mouth. Raisin bran. My favorite kind of muffin. Dense and nutrient-rich, with random bursts of sweetness. It's as if Detective